TED Audio Collective.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Hi, I'm Debbie Millman. Canva is great for designing visual content for work, no matter what industry or department you work in. Nail your next presentation with Canva Presentations. Start with a professionally designed template and use it as a springboard for your design. It's a serious time saver. Time to present but can't be there in person? Enter Canva Talking Presentations. Record yourself presenting and add your talking head to your slides so your audience can watch your perfected presentation anywhere, anytime. Start designing today at canva.com. Designed for work.
Support for Design Matters Media is provided by Wix.com, which puts the creative power of building dynamic websites back into the hands of designers. As anyone who has spent time in a WYSIWYG platform knows, what you see isn't necessarily always what you get. On the flip side, for some, it's far too easy to get lost in code and lose the forest for the trees. Wix.com allows you to find your own personal sweet spot and take control of your site with their drag-and-drop editor, hundreds of advanced design features such as retina-ready image galleries, custom font sets, HD video, and parallax scrolling effects, and even serverless, hassle-free coding for robust websites and applications. With Wix.com, you have total control of your web design like never before. So join Wix's brilliant community of designers, artists, and creatives at large around the world for free and ask yourself, what will you create today?
This is Design Matters with Debbie Millman from DesignObserver.com. For 14 years now, Debbie Millman has been talking with designers and other creative types about what they do, how they got to be who they are, and what they're thinking about. On this podcast, Debbie Millman talks with Adel Rodriguez about his celebrated illustrations of Trump.
You don't appease fascists. You really do confront it as strongly as possible. And that's what I wanted to do with that cover.
Here's Debbie Millman.
In April 1980, several hundred Cubans, fed up with a bleak economy, stormed the Peruvian embassy in Havana, demanding asylum. And over the next few days, their numbers grew to over 10,000. In response, Fidel Castro opened the port of Mariel to anyone wishing to leave Cuba, and they could, as long as they could arrange, to be picked up by boat. Family and friends in the United States quickly organized and sent hundreds of boats from Florida in what became known as the Mariel Boat Lift. 120,000 people made it out of Cuba, among them a 9-year-old boy named Adel Rodriguez. This 9-year-old boy went on to become one of the most celebrated illustrators in the United States, and today we're going to talk about that and his extraordinary life. Adel Rodriguez, welcome to Design Matters.
Thank you.
Adel, yesterday I was having a conversation with the designer James Victori. And when I told him I was interviewing you today, he called you the most dangerous man in the world. And I was wondering what you might think of that.
No, I'm sure there's a lot more dangerous people than me. But I don't mind that reputation. I'm fine with that.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your early origins and then talk about why you're so dangerous. You grew up in El Gabriel, a small rural town outside Havana, Cuba. Your family had to work to find food and basic supplies every day. You even made your own toys to play with. What was that all like for you?
It was just life. We never thought we were poor or It was just life. You woke up and you made your toys and you went out into the countryside and cut down some sugar cane and ate it for lunch. And it was actually a lot of fun. I didn't really think much of it. But, you know, my parents were aware of what was going on because they had lived before the revolution, when things were a little bit more put together. There were a lot more food, and there wasn't that much spying by the government. They weren't getting oppressed, so they're the ones that were kind of looking at me and my sister and trying to figure out what was going to happen to us in the future. So they were trying to look ahead a little bit. They knew that at some point I'd have to go into the military. When I was about 16 or 17, you have to go into the military, and at that time they were sending kids to Angola and to Africa to fight wars in Central America. And my father didn't want me to fight for something that he didn't really believe in. And we were already kind of getting indoctrinated in school, doing chants and things like that. And at some point they start turning the kids on their parents and snitching and things like that. So they could tell something was up, and they're the ones that got concerned and wanted to get us out. But to me, it was just a lot of fun. I loved my time in Cuba.
What kind of toys were you making?
Oh, we would make, you know, guns, which is what boys like to make. but guns out of wood, with, you know, the bullets were bottle caps, slingshots. You know, the one thing is that it at a very young age, I was just working with my hands all the time. And my entire life, I've just been making things with my hands.
You began to show a talent for drawing while sketching at your aunt's pharmacy in Cuba. What motivated you to want to draw there?
Paper. It's where she had paper. She had paper and she had pencils, and that's the one place where I found them. You know, my parents didn't really have paper at the house, so I would just go there, and I guess she wanted to keep me busy and the desk in the back of the pharmacy, so she just gave me paper and pencils, and I would just start drawing. I remember mostly drawing tanks. I was fascinated by military tanks at the time.
What did your family think of your drawing back then?
My family I love them, and they're wonderful, but they're very funny. It's really not, you're a kid doing whatever kid thing you're doing. It's a different sort of living than in the United States, where immediately you see potential in your child and you want to develop it and send them to art classes or whatever. No, you're just a child playing around, and everyone thinks it's silly. No one really took it that seriously. You know, except for my father. My father was always very encouraging, taking me to my art shows and things like that.
What were you thinking that you wanted to be at that point in your life when you got older?
Yeah, when I was a little boy, I wanted to be, you know, many different things. Policeman, fireman, the typical things that a kid wants to be. It's only when I got maybe into junior high or high school that I decided I wanted to be an architect. I was very good in math, science, and all of that. And an art, and then everyone just kept telling me, you know, go into architecture, you'd be a very good architect, and that was my focus, until I got an internship in an architecture firm my senior year of high school.
And what made you change your mind?
I just realized it was not for me. It was an awful sort of, not myself, even the architects were telling me, this is awful, you don't want to do this.
Really?
Yeah, there's no work. Nothing's predictable.
So you become an illustrator and said, when there's so much work and everything is predictable.
Well, I figured if I wasn't going to make any money, I might as well be an artist, which is what I really wanted to do. I was headed to go to architecture school, and then at the last minute changed my mind and went into more of a visual arts path.
You came to the U.S. at 9 years old during the Mariel Boatlift exodus, as I mentioned in the introduction. When you learned you were going to move to the United States, how did you feel?
I didn't know I was going to move to the United States. I was actually not told. I was told we were going to go visit my family in the United States. And it was a really tense time. There were a lot of things going on. And one of the things that was happening was that kids were telling their teachers that they were going to leave. The teachers would go snitch on the Communist Party headquarters. And the headquarters would go, you know, arrest the parents. There was a lot of tension going on. So my parents' main concern was that me or my sister would tell our teachers or tell people at school, and that the ball would kind of get rolling around town. And then when that happens, you have squads of people show up at your house that want to beat you up.
Or worse.
Yeah, the government would send people to do all sorts of things. So they didn't tell me. And at some point, they just said, we're going to go visit your uncle and your cousins. And I just kind of went along with it. So,
in order to get here, your aunt chartered a 68-foot shrimp boat called the Nature Boy. A photojournalist was aboard the ship, as were convicts that the Cuban government forced your family to take out of the country. And years later, you found a photo of yourself arriving in the United States in the Time magazine archive. How vividly do you remember the experience?
We were in a camp for about a week's time. We were taken from our house on a military jeep. They confiscated our house. They took us in a jeep into basically this field where we were held for about a week. And there are a lot of things that happened there.
Were you scared?
Yeah. It was the first time, you know, I saw military dogs, German shepherds.
I mean, you thought you were going to visit family, right?
Yeah. At some point I realized, wait, where's my family? So, yeah, there were, you know, like a lot of military with bayonets, dogs getting sicked on prisoners in the middle of the night. It's the first time I saw my mom naked, you know, because when we went through the search, they took her clothes off to search her completely. So lately I've been interviewing my family about all of this to try to match my memories with what they know, because I'm writing a book about all of this. So at that time, we went to a camp for about a week, and the issue was that once you were in this camp, you were kind of in limbo. You could be taken out of the camp at any moment and sent back to your town, and you wouldn't have a house anymore or a job or anything. So that was why my father was so tense there, because they were taking fathers out, beating them up, bringing them back into the camp. And finally, one day they called our name. And by that time, I had set up a baseball team in the camp, so I didn't want to leave. We had regular
Always
baseball games.
Always the creator, huh?
And I was like, I don't want to leave. I got my friends here. And then my dad's like, you're crazy. Get out of here. Let's go. So then we were taking on a bus onto the ship. And once we were in the ship, that's when we saw our cousins finally.
Do you recall landing in Key West?
Yeah. Then, you know, they loaded the boat with prisoners. The boat took off around 10 p.m. and then we sailed all night, and I slept all night, and then in the morning around 6 or 7 I was awakened by the sunlight, and I remember seeing the keys, sort of smaller keys, started appearing, and then we landed. They pulled us off the boat, and we were welcomed by U.S. immigration and put into like a refugee center there, where we were fed and given clothes and lots of toys. I remember that there were piles and piles of toys that were donated, piles of soda, food, all sorts of things. And that's the one thing I remember the most, is how everything was just gleaming, like everything was bright, and so much of everything.
When you first arrived in Florida, you didn't speak any English, and you've said that your art was your way of communicating. At that point, what kinds of things were you drawing?
Well, there were times where, you know, you would get picked on at lunch, you know, and I remember kids would steal my lunch for some reason, and I didn't know what to say. Or if I needed help from another kid, I would sketch out, you know, a boy hit me. Or, you know, it was just basic communication done through drawing, like cartoons, to try to explain to the teacher, to the kids what happened. But that was that summer. And that was like a summer school, and it was all with English-speaking kids for the most part. The next fall, we were all, this entire population basically that arrived in Miami, we were all put together into classes. So my third grade class was refugees that had just arrived from Cuba, and we were third graders placed into a junior high.
Interesting.
And they had empty classrooms that basically where we were taking our classes were. So you were all of a sudden mixed up with older kids as a third grader, but that was what they had to do at the time.
In some ways, do you see your art as communication as essential in the development of your ability?
Yeah. I think that is basically what I've always done. From that point forward, it's a communication tool. I see most of everything that I do as communicating, and the art is sometimes secondary. It's strange.
after 2 short years living in the United States, having come to this country, not being able to speak a word of English, you became an English language spelling bee champion. How on earth did you accomplish that?
I have no idea. I think it was just that I had a very visual memory, and I would get these lists and I would just memorize words, and it was like a photographic memory. So yeah, I beat every kid in my class. I beat every kid in the school. Actually, not in the school. In the school, I remember Peter beat me. I still remember him. And then me and him went into the
championship?
County. Yeah, yeah. But yeah, that's when I realized it was much harder.
It's extraordinary.
Yeah.
In Cuba, your father was a photographer, in addition to a restaurant manager and a taxi driver. And those are just a few of his jobs. He had a lot of jobs. Early on in the U.S., he had a trucking company, and he'd tell you that you had to study or you'd end up like him, which influenced your passion and your drive. Did it bother you that he didn't want you to be like him?
No, no. He would say that every day. He usually would say it when it was the worst time of the day, so that it really made an impact. You know, we were on the side of a road in a ditch trying to pull something out, and it wouldn't come out, and he'd be there for an hour. And he's like, don't, you know, go to school. You don't have to do this garbage. And it stayed with me, you know. He's always looking for something better. And he's the crazy one that would just go on a limb to do something. And it was really his idea to leave Cuba because we were, you know, as bad as things were, things were okay, you know, and my mom was very comfortable. And I asked my mom, Leo, what made you get on a boat, you know? And it was really my father just constantly kind of going after her and saying, we have to leave, we have to leave. So he's always been the one. And even when I wanted to leave Miami to come to New York, he's the one that took me to the airport. You know,
your mom wouldn't even go, right?
My mom would not go to the airport.
she went from Cuba to the United States, but she wouldn't take the trip to the airport.
She holds a grudge.
She didn't want you to leave.
No, no. So he took me to the airport. He gave me cash when I got on the plane. And he's always like that, kind of a bit of a dreamer and to go for things. So.
And that was your first plane ride, I believe,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that was the first time. I was 18 and I took a plane ride to New York City for the first time on a plane.
Now, going back to high school for a minute, you entered a cover art scholarship competition that was sponsored by Time Magazine. And you not only won first place, you also nabbed a free subscription, which was your first magazine subscription ever, from what I understand.
You know everything.
I try. So tell us about the cover that you, where can we see this image?
Actually, I have a photograph of it at home. There was this competition. My parents hadn't saved anything for college, so I started in high school looking for anything, any opportunities where I could get money for college. And one of them was this scholarship competition from Time Magazine that my art teacher handed to me. So I created a cover concept, which was about the environment. And there's a nice image of a beautiful landscape, and there's a hand coming down, tearing it apart. And behind it are like nuclear plants and things like that. And I sent it to the competition. I heard back that I won, and I got some scholarship money from Time Magazine.
I mean, that's amazing.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah. And then at the same time, it was 11th grade probably. I got an automatic subscription to Time, and I started getting it every week. And we didn't have any magazines at my house. So that was the only magazine that I would ever look at was Time Magazine. Yeah. I loved it. I became obsessed with Time. And the graphics in it and illustrations and all of that. And what's funny is they have this weird connection, constant connection to Time Magazine, because I won that. And then years later, when I started working at Time Magazine, I mentioned it to my the art director at the time. And he's like, oh, I was the judge on that.
Oh, wow.
So I brought him and he's like, oh, I remember your image. Yeah.
We'll have to make it available for our
listeners to
be able to see what it looked like. After graduating high school, you turned down a full ride at the University of Miami to attend Pratt. Mm-hmm. Why?
I got a full scholarship to go to University of Miami for art, and I was set to go. And then my high school art teacher, who had a lot of influence over where I went and what I did, and she brought me literally to the portfolio day. She drove me there. She kind of took care of me. I was really the most talented kid in her class, so she wanted me to do something with it. So she arranged for me to meet a former student of hers that was a Pratt student. He came back to high school and he spoke to me and told me everything about Pratt, told me that I should come visit. So that was the first trip. I went and visited Pratt during spring weekend, and I stayed with him, and he showed me New York City. He took me to the Guggenheim, the Met, and I was just going crazy. I couldn't believe what New York City was. So once I had been here for a weekend, I just said, I'm not going to Miami. I'm not going to University of Miami. I have to figure out a way to get up there. So I started just harassing the financial aid person at Pratt every week. I just said, I really want to go there, but I have a full scholarship to the University of Miami. What can you guys do? So I became like a hustler with my admissions people. I negotiated it down from, I think it was like $25,000 that I would have to pay. And at the end of the day, they said, okay, finally, we've worked out a deal with all your grants and all this. All you have to pay is $1,000 each semester. And that's when I went. That I hadn't told anything to my parents. And finally, when I had it down to $1,000, I went and talked to my parents. And they said, are you crazy? We don't have that money. So I don't know
The Time Magazine scholarship money.
Yeah,
right?
I think I actually took like a loan for just $1,000 or something. Yeah, it just became a big sort of problem at my house, arguing with my mother, and they just didn't want me to leave. They really felt like we had left Cuba, and that was a big deal. And to have me leave the family again was not what my mom wanted, basically. And I said, "Oh, I'll be back in 3 years. I'll do it quickly."
How many years ago was that?
I don't know, 28 or something. Yeah,
they're okay now with it.
No. my father doesn't care, but my mother, she's very dramatic in a funny way.
I read that you once visited the Society of Illustrators and looked at all of the names on the wall and figured you'd have to change your name to fit the anglicized mold of the names that were there. When did you start feeling that way?
I don't know. I guess when my name started appearing on the walls or something. I think there's something, when you're young, you're always looking for people that are like you, that are doing what you want to do. At the time, I was like, E.R. Alonzo, or what would... and that was the thinking, I just have a very funny sounding name, so...
You now teach at the School of Visual Arts, mm-hmm. and I know you take quite an interest in young illustrators today. Do you feel like the diversity of the field is beginning to change?
Yeah, I think it started changing a long time ago, maybe 10 or 15 years ago. It started changing quite a bit for a lot of different reasons. I think the internet changed that because you have all of a sudden artists and illustrators from other countries could start working in the American market. So the names and the diversity started happening a lot more. Yeah, it's definitely changed, I think.
You started working at Time Magazine as a temp. You started as a temp and then you worked your way up to becoming a designer. How did you first get the opportunity to temp?
When I was at Pratt Institute, I was studying, and my last year of school, my English teacher there said, you guys that are graduating, if you need a job, when you get out, my husband works at Time Magazine, you should give him a call. I remember those words, and I just went, Time Magazine.
Right, of course.
that's where I've always went. And I was like, I can't believe that someone's telling me this. And weeks went by, months went by, and I just started, I had been applying to a lot of different kinds of jobs and not getting anything. I think I'd called about 60 magazines.
60?
Yeah. Everything, details, Village Voice, this, that. I was kind of applying and trying to get into magazines anywhere. But my portfolio wasn't quite there. It was basically a portfolio from my college newspaper because I had studied painting. I hadn't studied.
You also got a master's in fine arts.
Yeah, right? That was right around the same time. So I was more in the fine art realm, but I needed a job. So I was looking for a design job because it's what I knew at the time. And after being very frustrated, it popped back into my head again, this thing that my teacher had said. So I went to the masthead and I looked up her last name to see if it matched someone on the list, and it was Conley, and there was someone on the list on the masthead named Steve Conley. So I just randomly called Time Magazine and asked for Steve Conley. I told him the story that his wife had mentioned. If we were looking for a job, we can call him. And I said, I'm looking for a job. And he said, oh, come by tomorrow. Let me look at your work. I showed up and I had a suit. And I remember him making fun of me for wearing a suit. And then he's like, well, we don't have anything right now for design, but we have someone that, you know, delivers copies around the office. He's going on jury duty. You could do his job for a couple of weeks. And I said, sure. And I took it, did that for a couple of weeks. And then while I was doing that, showed that I could do some design and kept haranguing people to hire me as a designer. And and then, you know, they liked me and they just kept me on there, just sort of like doing minor design tweaks and things. And I got hired permanently about 9 months later.
1994. Yeah. You maintained a successful freelance career as well. Mm-hmm. You hold the distinction of being the magazine's youngest art director for the Canada and Latin America editions. Mm-hmm. And you said this, I come from a family of very hardworking peasants and farmers, so I don't think office work or drawing is hard labor. I laugh at it sometimes. It's nothing compared to what my parents or grandparents have done. So this keeps it all in perspective. What does it mean now to your parents to see you reach this kind of success in your career?
Yeah, no, I think they're very happy and proud and occasionally confused.
What are they confused by?
Just the things that I do sometimes, the graphics and the
how
visuals that I create.
Or...
Yeah, yeah. Why do I do this? And yeah, my father is crazy. My father is up for anything. But my mom's concerned sometimes, so she'll like call me and say, "What do you have? Well, don't go that far. What are you doing?" I think there's, when you've lived in a place like that, there's always something in the back of your mind that someone's watching you and someone's keeping a record of everything that you're doing, and that it'll, you know, you have a good life. Why are you doing this? That kind of stuff. And I've had a few arguments with them, with her, and just sort of explaining that I follow my gut and what I want to do. I don't really think about repercussions. I just do what I want to do.
Well, I guess that's why James Victoria considers you the most dangerous man in the world right now. Let's talk about some of your covers. Your cover for Newsweek, What Silicon Valley Thinks of Women, that issue won a National Magazine Award. And it also stirred up a fair amount of controversy. Prior to that, your work appeared on the cover of Communication Arts. It showed Che Guevara with a Nike swoosh on his hat and Apple earbuds, which is a bit like blasphemy to the people in Cuba. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there's your amazing Trump covers for Time, which landed you on Ad Age's 50 Most Creative People of the Year list in 2016, alongside Frank Ocean, Prince, Tom Ford, David Bowie, and Beyoncé.
How ridiculous is that, right?
Well, I think it's kind of amazing. It's kind of amazing. How do you feel about all this press?
I'm just always shocked by all of it. I'm surprised by anything that happens in my life on a regular basis. So I'm always telling friends or asking someone, like, is this really happening? Is this, you know, am I on this list with these people? Am I doing this? Is this, you know, because it's really strange to me. It's exciting and it's fun. And it's actually what I've learned is how sometimes simple it is to get to places where you never dreamed you'd be at. If you just kind of work and show it and be open, not be scared, speak your mind, confront problems, confront people that you think are not good for society, you know. So when you're honest, people just get a vibe off it and they just want to... be near that or be close to that. And that's what I try to do with my work.
Let's talk about the Time magazine cover from 2016, the meltdown cover. Mm-hmm. It showed an illustrated Trump literally melting. How did you come up with the idea?
I've been doing sort of these kinds of images that where the face or something is kind of falling down or falling apart. I had been doing it a few times. I actually did it with a portrait of Gaddafi for Newsweek after they killed him. And it was very similar, this sort of graphic of things melting down. And the art director of Time, D.W. Pine, called me and said, hey, I have an idea. It's actually like kind of like his idea with my stuff. And the way I work with D.W. is like that. He knows my vocabulary, knows my things. And he's like, we have a headline. It's called Meltdown. We want a face of him melting down. It was not that complicated. And I just followed along and you know, we worked on it together. And, you know, the trick was to making it work, you know, because you can do a face that has a bunch of details. You can do all. And I really wanted it to just focus on his mouth. And it was all about him screaming. And that's really what got him in trouble all the time was this. He can't stop talking. So I did this the image, and I actually thought when I turned it in that it would just never be published.
Why?
Which happens very much at Time Magazine. At the time, it was in the middle of the election, and there's always a sense of being conservative around the time of an election and being neutral, or whatever. But Trump had gone so far and done and said so many awful things that even Time Magazine had turned on him. And not turned on him, but just wanted to really show what was going on. It was so out there. It was at the time that he was making fun or mocking the family of the Muslim
Gold
soldier.
Star family,
yeah, Gold Star family. I always turn my artwork in and I just detach and I don't, you know, see what happens. And then I started hearing that it was published on the internet. And I'm like, oh, wow, they published it. I actually never heard back from the art director. Yeah, it
was
made
the cover that was heard around the world, and I think it ushered in a really new phase of illustration work on magazine covers, much stronger, much more direct, much more brutal.
Yeah, that's the right word, brutal. The danger that we were facing and that we are occasionally still facing in this country is this neutrality, this oh, both sides have their own point of view, we need to listen to both sides, that kind of thing, which liberals practice very, very well. You know, it's this very thing of oh, let's just listen. Let's you know, they have concerns. Let's listen to that. Or he said this. Let's listen to it and take into account. But I really got to a point where I felt you needed to confront this. It was basically fascism in the United States, and you don't appease fascists. You really do confront it as strongly as possible. And that's what I wanted to do with that cover. You know, making him orange is a very strong visual. It's taking what he kind of looks like and then tweak it even more. So I wanted that strength. It was just nice to have the backing of the magazine. Because once that Time Magazine does that, then everybody else is like, oh, okay, we can do it too. We can confront this in the same way. What I had been doing for about 6 months before was to do this stuff on my own, do these graphics on my own, and put them out there. I've been doing things on Twitter and Facebook, and all these art directors at these magazines follow my work. So I was trying to sort of change the mentality and create sort of a brand of Trump as what he really was. And I was just kind of waiting for magazines or clients to catch up, or waiting for a moment where I could stick it into the sketch phase or send it to a client. And it happened. It started happening about 6 months or a year after I was working. I was doing this kind of stuff during the primaries.
So you were doing it. You were self-generating the work, and then it.
Yeah, and that was the idea. That was the idea. About 2 years earlier, I had done a similar campaign on ISIS, where I felt what was happening with ISIS was so strong, and nobody was really covering it with strength. And I started doing this work about ISIS and being very strong, mostly on the internet. And at some point, I started getting hired to do this ISIS work for the New York Times and for a bunch of other places. I've been working with these publications for such a long time. You do your sketches, you get to a point, and they're like, whoa, 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 that's too much, that's too strong, and it gets dialed back. So I was trying to find a way to subvert that process. And the way I found was to get ahead of it, put things out myself, have fan base or people on the internet sharing, commenting. And when it becomes so big, all of a sudden clients want a part of that, which is what I found over the last 2 years, roughly, is a different way of working.
Did you go to Time with the total meltdown follow-up, or did they come to you and ask you to do it?
No, that was...
Because that made it even more brilliant.
No, that was also them. That was also... it was at a point where it was a funny week. The Hollywood reporter, Hollywood, I forget,
Access Hollywood
tape had come out. And I got another call from the art director, DW, and he said, hey, we want you to do a similar thing, but do the GOP logo melting down. And I was like, that's kind of weird, you know, like just repeating as a GOP logo. And I tried it. I sent it to them. And they held on to it, and I never heard back until Wednesday morning at 10, which is their publication day. The EWA calls, hey, we decided, we've gone through everything. We want to do a total Meltdown cover. Take your image and just splash it all the way down. And I was like, okay, when's the deadline? At noon. So it was a two-hour deadline to create this new piece of art. And I started frantically sketching and trying to figure out how to do that. It was actually, for me, it was difficult to do that compression and do it well. So I think I sent it around 11:45 or something. And then he's like, well, let's rework it. I'm like, we have no time. So they were treating it like a regular, you know, assignment where we tweak things. And then finally I was able to resolve it and it came out the next day. Yeah. But a lot, you know, Time definitely gets a lot of credit for writing the headlines and sort of like, working with me on these things.
I read that you'd much rather not be creating work about Trump.
Mm-hmm.
How do you manage to look at that face as much as you have to look at it?
I don't really look at him. I don't really look at pictures of him. It's like all just symbols and graphics in my head. I usually spend 10 minutes, 15 minutes, you know, on something. If it's a cover or
10 or 15 minutes?
Yeah, on a daily thing, like something that I might put on the internet. It's very fast, actually. If it's a cover, then definitely I'll spend more time tweaking it and things like that. You know, I could maybe do something in 3 or 4 hours. You know, part of the reason there's no visual cues that it's him is I don't want to draw his eyes and his nose and get involved in all of this stuff. I have friends that have painted him.
I'm like, yeah, Barry Blitt can do that.
Yeah. How could you like sit there and like render his face? I just can't do it. I wouldn't do it. So, for me, it's more of an object and a brand, sort of like I've created this branding and this brand of him, and I can now tweak it and change it. And it's not even him that I'm doing. It's more about, it's anti-branding. It's creating a brand and then doing everything to destroy it, basically.
Let's talk about your Der Spiegel cover, because mm-hmm. as intense and riveting as the Meltdown and Total right. Meltdown covers are and were, your Der Spiegel cover went even further. You created an image of Trump beheading the Statue of Liberty.
Mm-hmm.
It went viral. And you actually said that it was pretty hilarious that a drawing was making the world go nuts.
Mm-hmm.
How did you come up with that idea? How did Der Spiegel first respond to the drawing? Was there trepidation? And what's happened in the aftermath?
Well, I mean, it's definitely been the one image that has created the most controversy, most coverage. It went on for like 2 months of press, you know, coming to my studio, interviews. It's still happening, you know, about a year later.
I mean, that's a heart-stopping illustration.
Good. That's what I wanted. The storyline is that I had created a series of illustrations, probably about 10, you know, kind of taking ISIS to the max. And I felt that they were doing so many awful things that they were kind of killing themselves. So I created this image that was an ISIS terrorist with his arms up. He has a knife in one hand and his own head in the other, and he has no head. Like, he had cut off his own head. I did that in 2014. Then I was watching the news, and the Muslim ban happened overnight. You know, as planes were still in the air, you had planes trying to land. There were kids that were sent by themselves, and they were at the airport and they couldn't get out because they didn't have the permit to come into the country. Grandmothers that were coming in to have operations. And I was thrown back into when I came to the country when I was 9 years old, a kid trying to come in. And at that time, I was welcomed with open arms, brought in by immigration, fed.
Toys galore.
Yeah. And I remember that. I was like, what's happened to my country? This is the country, you know, this is our dream country. And the Statue of Liberty was something that we always talked about in my family. It was like a saint, like it was America, you know. So all these things were just popping into my head as I was watching TV. And I was disgusted by it because to me, that's something that Castro would do, something that a dictator would do.
You've compared Trump to Castro.
Yeah, yeah. That's how Castro and the communists in Cuba treated us when we were wanted to leave the country. We were put in this pen for a week and we were held and anything could happen. And it was this idea of toying with people's lives and emotions that really angered me. So out of just anger, I took the ISIS terrorist And it was the same figure, the same exact image. And I just put Trump's head on it and put a Statue of Liberty on his arm. And it was the same knife that the terrorist was holding. And I was making a direct correlation that the real terrorist was Donald Trump. The real person that's affecting lives at that time was Donald Trump. And since it was related to the Muslim ban, that was the connection, you know. Yes, he is an ISIS terrorist, basically, was the concept. And I posted it on Twitter and on Facebook and all my media channels, and it went nuts. That was my image, you know, I just put it on there. And then about a day or two later, Der Spiegel called me and was like, hey, we're doing a cover on the Muslim ban. Can you send us some ideas? And I was like, all right. You know, I did a bunch of other sketches. I don't even know where they are now. And I sent it to them and didn't hear back. And then the next day they said, oh, nothing's really quite working from this batch. Can you go back to it again and think of some other ideas? And I was like, all right, you know. And then all of a sudden, the next morning, the art director from Der Spiegel calls me and goes, hey, we've been looking through your Twitter feed. And there's this image that Trump as an ISIS guy. And we know, has that been published anywhere? And like, no. Can we publish that? And I was just like, are you guys crazy? You seriously want to publish this on the cover? And like, yeah, we really like it. And they said, well, can you just, he had a tunic on. Can you change that to Trump's suit so that it looks more like Trump? And I remember telling some friends, I think something's going to come out tomorrow that's going to cause a big deal. I hadn't done it about any other prior covers. And I was right. As soon as it came out, it created a big splash. The cover wasn't in and out. And next morning, it was already at protests at the airports. People had just printed it off the internet. And I have, you know, a bunch of pictures of people holding up.
You give people the permission to do that, right?
With not at that comments, time. Yeah, no. And at that time, I hadn't even thought of that. At that time, it was just people downloaded it off Twitter and created huge posters to bring to airports and all this kind of stuff. And it started just a lot of direct messages, a lot of emails, just insults and all sorts of things, and you know, calling me a closet communist, you know, every insult that you can think of, basically. I think it's really important to not normalize a lot of this stuff because it's coming at you so fast and so much that it can easily just change. And we're seeing it, you know, Fox News, which is just basically spouting lies on a constant basis. You know, we know these things aren't happening, so it's like an entire country that's just trying to be gaslighted all the time. And I think what I do with my work and what people many times react to is they go, wow, I'm not crazy. Okay, someone else sees what I saw, made an image about it. Okay, so we're all in this, you know, recognizing this reality because we're constantly told by the president and by many other people that didn't happen. That's not true. That's happened in Venezuela, in Cuba, in Russia, in many other countries. And we can't let it happen here. And it can.
Fast Company has dubbed you the preeminent illustrator of the Trump era. Do you look forward to the day you can stop illustrating him when this is all over?
Yeah, sketchbooks and a bunch of other things that I want to be painting. But I wake up every day and I'm like, oh, I got to say something about this. And but yeah, my favorite thing is to just be in my studio painting and making things that make no sense.
You've been involved in illustrating children's books now for almost two decades and have written and illustrated two of your own, focused on your penguin character, Sergio. You've said that one of your career highlights came when you heard one of your kids, then four, reading the book aloud to herself. And late last year, you told Print Magazine you were working on a kid's biography about Jimi Hendrix. And so I'm wondering where that stands and also your own personal illustrated memoir about your life and emigrating to the United States.
They've kind of taken like a little bit of a pause right now. I'm still working on the Jimi Hendrix book. And I'm definitely working on this memoir. That's a graphic novel, graphic memoir kind of book. A lot of what we've talked about today and trying to figure out the structure for it and how much of it is about Cuba, about coming here, about being a refugee in America. And now, because of who I am and what's happening now, it just raised it up even more. So I have to finish it, basically. My agent is mad at me.
Adele, my last question is about returning to Cuba. In 2014, you went back to Cuba for an exhibition of your own work, which was also the first time your children visited the country. What was it like to return, especially for an exhibition of what you've achieved since leaving? And what did your children think?
I've told the curator and the people in Havana that it's my favorite show. It's the best show of my life, basically. It meant that much to me. But, you know, it's really where my heart is always. It's in Cuba and where a lot of my influences and the music that I listen to and everything that I miss is Cuba all the time. And then I was able to go back and my family from my hometown, my friends were able to come out and see my work for the first time. And to be on that earth having that show was a big deal. And it was wonderful to take my kids and have them see the town that I grew up in, come into my house and all of that. It was it was a very powerful show.
Well, Adele, thank you so much for being on Design Matters today. Thank you so much for putting so much important work out into the world and motivating us to make a difference.
Thank you.
To see more of Adele Rodriguez's work, you can see his work on Instagram at Adele Rodriguez or on Twitter at Adele Studios. This is the 14th year I have been recording Design Matters, and I'd like to thank you for listening. And remember, we can talk about making a difference, we can make a difference, or we can do both. I'm Debbie Millman, and I look forward to talking with you again soon.
For more information about Design Matters or to subscribe to our newsletter, go to debbiemillman.com. If you love this podcast, please consider contributing to our new Drip Kickstarter community. Members get early access to the podcast, transcripts of every interview, invitations to live interviews, Q&A sessions with guests, and a brand new annual magazine. You can learn more about this at d.rip/Debbie-Millman. That's d.rip/Debbie-Millman. If you want others to know about this podcast, please write a review in the iTunes store and link to the podcast on social media. Design Matters is produced by Curtis Fox Productions. The show is published exclusively by DesignObserver.com and recorded live at the School of Visual Arts Masters in Branding program in New York City. The editor-in-chief of Design Matters Media is Zachary Pettit, and the art director is Emily Weiland. Generous support for Design Matters Media is provided by Wix.com.
You're growing a business, and you can't afford to slow down. If anything, you could probably use a few more hours in the day. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate, no coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.